there is just so much of this. It's like the genie's out the bottle. We can't put it back in again now. We're on this journey. And there are two things that seems to have happened probably about 18 months ago. One was the climate change, Greta kind of movement, if you like. And actually, it was when my daughter was talking to me and we're going on marches through the village. You know, it really brought it home, not only to me, because I already understood this, but for other people, when their children were talking to them, saying, you know, Dad, what are you doing about this? Suddenly they were like, okay, I can understand this now. And they were then taking that into their work. I think it's starting to land home.
Welcome to another episode of the ESG Factor podcast. I'm Vincent McCarthy. From our natural environment, we've extracted resources and created our built environment. Our cities, the infrastructure, the factories, the buildings, offices, homes, cars, trains, planes, you name it, humans have built it all. Now that's come with a lot of benefits, but there are also major challenges. The manner of extraction has meant that we've left a big environmental impact. The rate of extraction means that we're using up our planet at a faster rate than we could sustain. And as well as that, the built environment continues to emit carbon into the atmosphere. It's clear that for a more sustainable future, we need our built environment to be in better equilibrium with our natural environment. To talk to me about this today, I'm joined by Dan Grandage, Global Head of ESG, Private Markets and Real Estate at Aberdeen Standard Investments. Welcome, Dan. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
No problem. Hi, Vincent. Thanks for having me.
So could we maybe start by you telling us a little bit about how you think about sustainability within real assets like real estate?
Yeah, well, for me, the best place to start is actually as a comparison to other asset classes. So if you think about listed equities or fixed income, for example, which are the traditional sort of big asset classes in investment, for me, it makes a lot more sense and it's a lot more tangible to think about sustainability in a real assets context. Because it's a tangible asset, it's a physical asset. So when you're trying to think about ESG and listed equities, it's slightly conceptual because you're owning a part of a share of something else. Whereas when you think about real assets, you can visualize it. So you can think about, you know, leaving your home, which is a building, getting on a train, which is infrastructure, getting off the train, and I'm now walking down the street and I'm walking past private companies, which is private equity, and buildings form the fabric of everything that you're walking past on your way to work. So the built environment and real assets in particular are just part and parcel of what we do. So you can then, when you conceptualize that as a building, often when I'm talking to people, in fact, I always bring it back to their home because the home is a building. So I can say, well, imagine your house. You can imagine your windows. You can imagine your lighting. You can even imagine the smart meter in your house when I'm trying to talk about that. So it's much easier to understand from that perspective. So yeah, so it's quite easy to bring to life and to understand how the impact of that built environment can start to affect the world around it.
And just, I suppose most people would be familiar with the idea of carbon dioxide going into the atmosphere, that the basics of climate change, I think everybody's relatively familiar with now. But can you explain just how big a problem this is in terms of the emissions that are created from our built environment and in particular buildings?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm not going to have exact numbers, obviously, but the number that is often talked about for real estate is that it equates to about 40% of global emissions. So that's obviously a big number. It's a big proportion of the total global emissions. And it's also worth bringing to like what that means, because when you talk about emissions, you imagine smoke going up a chimney, that kind of thing. And obviously, there is an element of emissions associated with the energy use within the building, but also you need to think about the energy use that's gone into the construction of the building. So they're called embodied carbon. So that's the carbon which is actually built into the concrete and the steel and the fabric of the building. There is carbon within that as well as the carbon that's then used during the operational life of the building.
And I suppose we have built our environment over the last number of decades in a certain way. We obviously, you know, the population growth has been a big factor, the growth of China and the pace that they've been building cities. It's clear that we have to build more sustainable cities. We have to improve the existing stock that we have in terms of residential real estate, in terms of office buildings. What are you most focused on at the moment?
There's a range of aspects we're looking at. I mean, we've just created our net zero investment framework. So carbon obviously is a big challenge at the moment. So we've created the framework which allows us to set the rules around what we mean by carbon. As I've just said, you know, carbon is different, can mean different things in different circumstances. So we've created this framework which applies globally. It applies to all of our funds, and we're basically setting a target of achieving net zero by 2050. But each of our funds, and we have a number of real estate funds, direct real estate funds, each of those can move at a different speed within that. So certain funds might choose to make different decisions. They might choose to bring that 2050 earlier to say 2030. But we've set the guidelines, the parameters of that target. And also, actually, one thing I didn't talk about, which again I think is quite important when we're talking about carbon, and particularly in a real estate context, and this feeds into the framework, is not only are we looking at the carbon associated with the energy that the landlord supplies, but we're also looking at the energy that the occupier uses within the building as well. So if you imagine like an industrial building, the landlord typically would not have an energy supply into that building, but the occupier would, let's say Amazon or someone like that. We're capturing that within our carbon footprint. And that's quite an important distinction, because that's actually what's called a scope 3 emission. So normally you'd look at scope 1 and 2, which are your main direct emissions, and scope 3 would often be excluded from a carbon footprint. But the real estate industry is accepted that actually we need to capture that as well, because it's the emissions within the building, and they're utilizing the building, and the energy efficiency of that building affects that carbon or that energy. So it's important that we do capture that. So it's quite an important distinction to make sure that we, you know, people realize that we are capturing that. So anyway, that's the key focus we're looking at. We're also starting to also look at understanding the carbon footprint, firstly, as I mentioned, but also we're realizing that to get to that 2050 end date, it's very likely that we are not going to be able to get to that net position. So we will still have, irrespective of all the activities we're doing in terms of having more efficient buildings, both from a construction but an operational perspective, we're looking at having green energy supplies, we're looking at putting local solar panels on the building, those kind of things. Even if we do all those activities, there is still a residual carbon left at the end of that. So by the time we get to 2050, we will still not be in a net position. So we need to start working out what we do with that residual carbon and how we tackle that. And that's the journey we're now on, is how do we tackle that, residual carbon is how it's being described.
I suppose, first of all, there's a lot in that for people to understand, because they won't be familiar with scope 1, scope 2, scope 3, all these different jargon. But I think the clearest example for people that are thinking about real estate, imagine improving the rating, energy rating on your house, and then you all of a sudden leave the windows open. That's not going to help efficiency. And effectively what you're talking about is improving the process to ensure that the tenant behavior in terms of how they use the building can be better managed, so that there is less waste. And that's the big problem with real estate, isn't it? It's not just about creating more efficient buildings. It's ultimately the behavior on how buildings are used needs to change dramatically.
That's exactly right. And that's kind of what I was talking about. Probably I was using two technical terms, but the occupier is key to this. We have to, as a landlord, collaborate with the occupier so that they're using the building efficiently in the way that it was designed. And previously, there's been this kind of split incentive, because the landlord would have been responsible for procuring the energy. The landlord would have been responsible for the equipment that heats and cools the building in an office, I'm talking about here. But actually, it's the occupier who uses that. So they've got no, so there's no, there's a slight disconnect, because obviously one party is running the building, but the other party is using it, and there's no direct relationship. So trying to break that down so that all our what's the word I'm looking for? I've completely lost the word. But anyway, we're all focused in the same direction is essentially what I was trying to say.
You just basically, you're looking for an alignment of interest, basically.
That is actually the word I was looking for. Alignment.
Don't worry, you can use me as a dictionary. But yeah, no, I mean, it makes sense, because unless you have an alignment of the behavior, it's like creating these efficient buildings and then they're not used efficiently, we're not really achieving the benefits that we could achieve. So it's real cultural change in terms of how we work in real estate together, I think, between the tenants and the landlords.
It is, and I think that it doesn't sound that significant, but it really is, because actually even the word landlord and tenant suggests some kind of hierarchical relationship, and actually we need to collaborate. So we shouldn't really be using the word landlord tenant. It should be, well, maybe landlord or occupier or customer, probably. Yeah. Is a better word. So we really need to be changing the way that dynamic and that relationship, so that we're working more in tandem together.
And one of the examples that you provide, it's a great video, the 3-minute video that you've made. I've shared it with a lot of people. I'm making you famous, but you used the example of the construction at the airport. And what I found interesting was that one of your colleagues that was speaking was saying that we're putting, I think he called it conduit provision or something like that, into the ground, so that when the technology improves, that they can actually put battery technology into the ground. So that seems to be what you're trying to do, is to build for the future, knowing that technology is going to improve.
That's exactly right. You've kind of stolen my thunder there, really. you've watched the video too many times.
I have. I used it on my course as well, so I've seen it many times.
But no, that's absolutely right. We're trying to design now for tomorrow, and we're trying to build now for tomorrow's regulations, but also tomorrow's occupiers' requirements as well. So we're not only just building a building, we're trying to think about how that building is going to be used. So do we need to increase the electricity power that's coming into the building to allow electric vehicle charging for fleet and for personal usage, but also do we need to think about battery storage? And although battery storage might not be commercially viable today, it probably will be tomorrow. So do we need to put more conduits within the apron, so that the external landscaping hardscape to allow us to have that channels and the cabling to allow that connection to the electric vehicle? So yeah, it's all about thinking about building for tomorrow, basically. And we do the same from an energy efficiency perspective. You know, we can see the direction of travel. So we're not building to just achieve today's building regulation compliance. We're starting to build for where we can see that decarbonisation pathway going. That's where we're going. We're building into what we believe the future will look like, which is a very different mindset, because I think real estate in particular used to just build for compliance and design for compliance, especially in the UK. It was very much following code and designing for compliance. And I think Australia and what they've done around neighbours, where it's all been designing for performance, which is sounds slightly nebulous difference, but it is very important difference. Designing for performance is about designing to make sure it operates in the way it was intended, not just, you know, I've been told to build X, and so I've done X, irrespective of how it might well be used. So it's a different way of looking at things.
And is anything materially changing in terms of the extraction process? Because ultimately, if you need to build a building, you still need the materials. So in terms of how we extract those materials for the construction process, is there a change in terms of how we do that? And is there new materials coming along that are potentially more sustainable? Because everybody wants to be sustainable now, and you're seeing construction companies say they're committed to sustainability, but how much can they really do?
It's a good question. It's a really hard one. There are changes. Sorry, yes. We are looking to use more recycled concrete, for example. So that reduces the carbon, because obviously the carbon is still being reused. And actually, just on your typical kind of external areas, we're looking to use recycled concrete on those. You can get up to about 80% recycled concrete. So that then you've that stored carbon within that concrete is still retained. But we're actually trialing on another airport scheme, timber. So can we use timber in a typical industrial building? Now, we haven't got to site yet, so this is still fairly early days, but that's what we're looking to do, is can we use different materials? We've been using timber for hundreds of years, so why can't we stopped when we discovered steel, but actually it does have some benefits. So can we utilize that? And then the other aspect as well is this kind of that circularity, that actually can we design buildings better so that they can be deconstructed at end of life, and those materials can then be reused? And again, we've had buildings where we've done that, and so we've designed them. So I mean, normally, for example, steel would be encased in concrete, and then therefore you can't recycle it, because you can't remove the concrete from the steel. But actually, if you design it for deconstruction from the outset. It's easier to do that. It's easier to decouple them. And it's easier actually to make sure that at the end of life, there is still value in that building in a way that actually conventionally you wouldn't achieve. So that's how to get around that. So definitely this changing behavior around the design of the buildings. And I'm sure more techniques and materials will come in. And there's a whole sort of various initiatives looking at sort of modular construction as well, particularly in residential. But you know, what can you do in a factory where you've got much less wastage, and then take that pre-built fabricated building and use that? Now currently it's largely with as I said, residential, but I can't see why that couldn't be rolled out to other areas as well. So there's a lot happening, but I think there's still a long way to
go. And you mentioned at the start in terms of basically no matter how good you are effectively in terms of planning for net zero, there's always going to be some residual carbon left over. And you introduced me to a new term to add to the terminology that we already have in setting, where you're addressing that residual carbon. And what I believe it to be is that rather than paying somebody else to offset the carbon, you're actually taking control of that and doing things within the portfolio to try and offset that residual carbon.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And actually, there's a technical term for it as well. It's actually called scope four.
Scope four. Okay, yeah. Make it more complicated for people. Nice
yeah,
one.
Yeah. If you wait long enough, we'll get up to 10. But seriously, you're absolutely right. So the difference is offsetting is when you're not in direct control of that carbon removal activity. And as you say, you essentially paying a third party to do some carbon removal activity, and you're then taking the benefit of that. Insetting is when you are doing some kind of carbon removal activity directly yourself within, in this context, within a fund structure. And actually the scope four term, actually just to bring that to life a little bit, actually means either avoided carbon or removed carbon. So if you've done something that's avoided carbon usage, that's what's captured under scope four. It's not widely used, but that's what that concept means. But from an insetting perspective, we're absolutely looking at that because we have this residual carbon. So rather than paying someone else to deal with the problem, and actually, if you do that, actually, from a whole world perspective, a whole system perspective, you still end up with the same carbon. So you've not actually done anything. All you've done is still got exactly the same amount of carbon. It's just you've just moved it around the world. So what we're looking at is, can we do something to remove that? And in a moment, what we're looking at are, you know, kind of forestry projects. So can we, as an investor, invest in a piece of land, grow forestry on that, sequester carbon, which is equivalent to the residual amount that we've already modeled, to remove that from the atmosphere to get us to that net zero position. That, you know, we're still early days, we've got a long way to go, but essentially what you'll be doing there is, the reason you would do that is you'd be hedging against the increasing in carbon price. So if you didn't do that, you'd then have to go to market. And let's say we get to 2050 and the cost of carbon is £100 a ton, for argument's sake, and it's today at £20 a ton. You're effectively investing your money now in that forestry, because you can still keep it at that £20 a ton, so that when you need it in 2050, you've got some £20 a ton pre-prepared forestry, as opposed to having to go out to the market and buy it at £100 a ton. So there's a hedging strategy, essentially. No kind of forestry hedging, pun intended. But that's a strategy. So that's what we're working on at the moment. And it's really interesting to see if we can do that. And the really good thing about that is we're not looking at timber necessarily. We're looking at broadleaf, not oak, so that we have an additional biodiversity benefit to that. So it's putting more back into nature. There's probably an amenity aspect. I mean, there's no reason people couldn't use that land for, you know, for bikes or walking or whatever. So it's having a additional co-benefits, but its main purpose is to remove carbon. I mean, there is another angle. If we do go down the timber route, the reason we've been excluding it to date is because you really have to be careful what happens to that timber. You have to manage the end of life of that timber, because what you don't want to happen is it just goes out and gets turned into bio pellets and then gets burnt, because all you're doing is releasing the carbon back up. But if you, in theory, coming back to the earlier conversation about using timber in industrial build or buildings, if you could grow timber to then use in buildings, you've got quite a nice circularity going on there. Again, we're a few years away.
Further away. Well, what I do like about it, though, is that it does, just from an accountability perspective, because that's what really, you know, is at the heart of ESG in terms of stewardship. That accountability element is hugely important.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And I think gone are the days where you can just offset offset and forget, as it were. More and more of our clients want that to feel they have the responsibility to take control of their emissions and have direct responsibility for that. And I think that could only be a positive thing. And I think the more we do that, the better we will all be. So I think it's absolutely a positive way forward.
I also think the point you make around biodiversity is important, because I was talking to a company in Ireland here that were recently founded, Virid are called, and when they were talking about forests, they were also saying about the carbon offset, but they were also talking about the connection with nature. And I think that's something that has been lost, or connection with the natural world. So when they're talking about forestry, they're from Wicklow, so they're very connected with their local amenities there in terms of forestry and walks, etc. But I think that's also important, that people have kind of lost their connection with the natural world. And if we can create new forests that can offset carbon, but also bring people more connected with the natural world, that's got to be a good thing.
Totally agree. I think it's absolutely the future. And I think we can't look at all these as disconnected silos. All of this is connected. And the more we try and increase that connectivity, the better. And, you know, if we can create amenity for the local community at the same time as serving a purpose from an investment perspective, then all the better. Why would you not do that? And to be honest, ESG in general is a roundabout that, is a roundabout aligning the interests, the phrase that I couldn't remember earlier on. But it is all around that. It's just making sure that, you know, everyone is actually focused on the same thing and everyone can see the benefit. And it's a true win-win. So I personally think forestry is the future, but I think we're a little bit way to go before we get there.
Yeah. And when ultimately, as we're having a conversation here, people are making decisions in trustee boards, investment committees, etc. You know, you're working with your clients. You need people, you know, to do good. You need people to invest in your funds, ultimately. So you need people to understand that there's a long-term project here that we're building for the future. What kind of challenges are you running into? Because I know that working with different investment committees and trustee boards, there's some people that get it. There's some people that realize that, look, we need to protect the planet for future generations. We need to be more sustainable, where there's others that have maybe very entrenched beliefs and don't even want to entertain the idea of it.
It's a good question. And it's I'm not saying it's easy, but it's definitely got easier. I've been involved in this field for, you know, I don't know, getting on for 20 years, or maybe just past, I've lost track. But in that time, you can see the difference. And in particular, the last 18 months to 2 years, there's been a real change. The way our investors are thinking and talking is absolutely aligned with this agenda. And to be honest, even if they are not, and they're not 100% convinced, regulations are pushing them in this direction. And their actual pension holders and unit holders are also pushing them in this direction. They're starting to get asked questions. Well, I've invested my money with you. What are you doing from a carbon perspective? Or what are you doing from a climate risk perspective? They then turn around and say, you're managing the money on behalf of the fund. What are you doing from a climate perspective? What are you doing from a carbon? So we have to have an answer. So it's shifted from us trying to convince and cajole to us actually being able to try to keep up with their aspirations, because we have some of our investors who are, you know, really trying to put some stretch targets out there, really some quite big commitments, and we need to make sure we can keep up with them. So, you know, whether we get to a point when we have a bit of a two-tier market, we have those who've absolutely got it and they're, you know, shooting the lights out and you know, really stretching. And then there's this group who have not, but I think they'll be caught by legislation. They will be caught by requirements and market pressures. So I'm very positive about the future from this respect. Certainly, you know, what you see is just, it's just incredible in terms of the what's happening in the wider market and the changing of perceptions.
And I think it comes back to that point around hedging for the future, because hedging is probably a word that people be trying to understand what we're talking about. But basically, if you have carbon prices that are priced at a certain level today, because what people aren't aware of is that over the last number of decades, there wasn't a cost associated with some of these negative impacts like carbon emissions. And as regulation has moved forward, they've tried to put a cost on things like carbon so that these negative externalities are priced. Now, what you're doing in terms of your portfolio and planning for the future, you're saying that, well, potentially this carbon price is going to increase in the future. And we need to prepare for that. So we need to build our buildings more efficiently. And we need to also prepare for that the cost associated with those carbon emissions are going to go up. So it from even though people are like don't want some people don't want to hear about sustainability in the planet, from a business perspective, this just makes perfect sense.
Absolutely. It really does. And this is kind of what I was just saying is, you know, I've noticed a real change that I'm not having to constantly convince. People can see that, and regulations are driving this, and, you know, basic building compliance and building regulations are driving this behavior anyway. But that there is just so much of this. It's like the genie's out the bottle. We can't put it back in again now. We're on this journey. And I think what's, for me, I think is really shit. I don't know whether it was actually this, but there are two things that seem to have happened probably about 18 months ago. One was the climate change, Greta kind of movement, if you like. And actually, it was when my daughter was talking to me and we're going on marches through the village. You know, it really brought it home, not only to me, because I already understood this, but for other people, when their children were talking to them, saying, you know, Dad, what are you doing about this? Suddenly they were like, okay, I can understand this now. And they were then taking that into their work. So there was that. And then there was also all the David Attenborough kind of BBC shows, The Planet, etc. When, again, he's really changed the way he's talking in the last couple of years, and he's really pushing this. And I think that really brings, when it's beamed into your front room and it's you're saying, look, there is a real problem with this, and this is bigger than just carbon, but it's human behavior. I think it's starting to land home. So it's yeah, really interesting to see.
Yeah, I think that's it. And it's bringing it into people's front rooms, you know, because ultimately people are busy with their 9 to 5 or just getting on with life. People are just trying to survive, a lot of people. And it's about making the connection and making people aware of what's going on. I know, and I was reading a book there recently, and they were trying to, basically the president of the United States obviously has the power to blow up half the world, the nuclear codes, right? So in this, I think it was the 70s or the 80s, the scientists were coming up with, behavioral scientists were coming up with ideas. Well, how could we better manage that so that we wouldn't be under the influence of just one individual that potentially could go crazy, right? So you wanted to have some level of rationale in terms of them making that final decision. Okay, literally, you're going to be killing a lot of people here, right? So they needed to make that connection. And one individual recommended that when they were about to press the button, that they would have to kill somebody on the spot before they pressed the button to understand the gravity of what they were going to do, right? And when I read that, I know it's obviously extreme, it never happened, but they're not going to employ that policy as far as I know. But to a certain extent, I think that maybe if people in trustee boards and investment committees and et cetera that are making big decisions on investments had more of a connection to understand, okay, well, this decision is going to have a knock-on effect that it's going to remove this section of the Amazon, it's going to remove this level of biodiversity. Those types of things. That's why I loved Attenborough's documentary, because it brings it to life.
Yeah, it does bring it to life. And I think that's what we're starting to do as well with our, you know, it sounds very boring now, gone from David Attenborough to what I'm about to talk about, but is the reporting that we give to our clients, to investors, and for them to pass on to their trustees, is the level of disclosure that we give them now on the carbon footprint and actually the impacts associated with their investments is just gone up exponentially, so that they can really start to understand the impact of their investments. And actually what some work we're starting to do on is rather than just focus on a few key ESG issues, we're actually looking at the impact of every investment. So what's the positive impact of that investment? Well, what are the negative impacts of that investment? And I'm not talking about impact investing, which is obviously a different topic, but the impact of the investment on society. And what does that look like? And actually reporting that back to investors as well, so that they can really see that there are sometimes things we're investing in which are actually not having a positive impact. So it's a bit of a change.
Yeah, that's what I try to explain to people as well, that every individual, every business, every country has a list of positive and negative impacts, and our objective is to try and reduce down those negative impacts as much as possible. Just to give you a nice proverb to end today's podcast, I think you'll like, and I think it's very apt. A society grows great when old men plant trees in whose shade they know they shall never sit. And I think this is particularly apt because we need to build more trees, but from a literal perspective. But I think that's what we need to be thinking about. We need to be thinking about future generations when we make these big decisions, and to think long term rather than short term.
It's a brilliant proverb. I am going to use that again. I might change it from old men to men like me. Obviously not old. but I think it's absolutely right. It's about that forward long-term thinking. I mean, the stuff we're doing around, you know, forestry, these are not 2, 3, 5 year projects. We're talking 30, 40, 50, 60 years into the future. I'm not going to be working then, but we need to be thinking about that. Absolutely. Makes sense.
That's it. We need to be thinking long term. And I think people, like even on the courses that I do, I say, well, look, if you've got kids, if you've got grandkids, you need to be thinking about what the future is going to be like for them. So just thinking in financial terms and through a numerical lens isn't enough anymore. And that's part of what makes this challenging, is that it's not just raw numbers. There's actually an emotional side of this as well, to make people think differently. So listen, thank you very much for your time and coming on the podcast. Hopefully we'll get you on again at some stage. If anyone wants to check out that video, we'll put a link into it to make it even more famous about the airport one.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thanks very much, Vincent. And a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Cheers, Dan. Cheers for listening to the ESG Factor podcast. If you're interested in a more sustainable future, then check out theesgfactor.com for details on our Patreon community and how you can support the making of more content like this. I'm Vincent, and I'll catch you later.